Hello and welcome to The Stushy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name's David Clegg, the editor of The Courier, and today I'm joined by a vast array of journalistic talent. From The Courier, I have our political correspondent, Derek Healy. From The Press and Journal, I have their Westminster correspondent, Dan O'Donoghue. From the Aberdeen Evening Express, I have their political correspondent, Adele Merson. And from across the company and being overworked very much, I have our stats guru, Leslie Ann Kelly. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
So I think there's just as we were coming on to record the podcast, a press release has dropped, which has actually got some interesting information about where we are with coronavirus. And one of the issues I think that's been quite prominent this week, how the differing devolved administrations across the UK are dealing with it. Derek, can you bring us up to speed with that?
Yeah, this is sort of breaking news, really. As you say, it's an email that's just dropped. It comes from, or on behalf of the UK government and all of the devolved administrations. It's talking about, really, the COBRA meeting that took place earlier this week. But interestingly, in one of the paragraphs here talking about what they're going to do and take forward, it refers, I'll read it out exactly, it says, "We are seeing the start of a second wave." That's actually quite a change in language, particularly in Scotland, because if you look at even just last month, Nicola Sturgeon was talking about how we are not seeing a second wave at the moment. This is a spike in the first wave, but it's not clear if there'll be a second wave of the virus coming down the line. So this is now all of the governments for the UK agreeing that we are seeing the start of a second wave, and I think that's probably a pretty big change in direction there.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting that the four administrations have all agreed that. So it's that's the UK government, the Northern Ireland Executive, the Scottish government, and the Welsh government saying that there is now a second wave starting. Now, in some ways, I suppose that sounds like a statement of the obvious in some ways, given the news agenda over the last week or two, Leslie-Ann. But can you just get us up to date on where we are with the statistics and why it is that the information they're seeing has brought them to now declare that officially?
Yes, it's not been a great week for coronavirus statistics. On the 23rd, we had the highest ever cases, so higher than the peak of the virus. Now, at the peak, obviously, we've spoken about before that the cases that were discovered and tested positive during the peak were likely the tip of the iceberg, because we were really only testing people who were going into hospital and who were really sick with the virus. So, but on the 23rd, we had 486 cases. The highest cases that we had during the peak was on the 31st of March and was 430. So we've really surpassed that by quite a lot. To put that into perspective, the test positivity then was around a third of people who were tested were testing positive in March, whereas now it's around 7.8%, but that's above that 5% line. And that's obviously not great as well.
So I guess a couple of elements there is the cases are higher now, but the deaths are still substantially lower than obviously at that peak. What is doing that? Is it the age profile of the people that we're seeing testing positive now? Is it just because there's more testing being done, we're finding more cases which maybe aren't as severe, or what is the profile of the case positivity at the moment?
Yeah, it's pretty much all of the above, really. We're seeing a massive increase in cases in 15 to 19 year olds. I made a heat map earlier in the week to look at the kind of age ranges, and what you saw during the peak of the pandemic was the kind of 45 to 64, 75 plus age ranges were the kind of hotspots for the virus. And now we're really seeing the 15 to 19 age range back during the peak were really largely unaffected. You saw very, very few cases in that age range back then. Now what we're seeing is that's where on age range cases kind of have a bit of a lag on the data getting through, but on the 21st of September, for example, there were 143 cases in the 15 to 19 age range, which is the highest that it's ever been in that age range, and it was the highest age group cluster of that day. So yeah, we're seeing a massive change in where the cases are. However, it is having that, what I've spoken about in the last few weeks, the kind of taking it home to granny effect, because whilst we're not seeing the massive spike in deaths that we did during the peak, we are starting to see an increase in deaths. We've had, I think, 5 deaths this week. And when you look at the age ranges, they've all been in the 75 plus age range. So whilst we're seeing the concentration of cases in younger demographics, the deaths are still coming through and translating to the older age ranges. And yet it's much slower. It's not the same runaway rate that it was at the start of the pandemic, but it is starting to trickle through.
It is interesting, though, that while the cases are spiraling amongst the youth, it's actually it's still the very elderly that are dying, which does adds to this idea of how exactly you deal with that, how you organize society to protect people while keeping society as open as possible. Mm-hmm. We've seen that obviously this week with the new restrictions brought in across the UK, which differed from country to country. But what you're describing there does bear out this idea that while young people certainly don't have nothing to fear from the virus, because some young people have got very sick or indeed died from it. It is the elderly that are risking the most, and yet it's young people that are circulating and perhaps passing it on. But maybe move on to a bit about that. Those new restrictions which were announced at the start of the week. I think one of the interesting things about that was there was a slight differences across the UK, but what the main thing that was brought in everywhere was that pubs were given a curfew of 10 p.m. because there's concern that it's socializing, and especially socializing when alcohol is involved, primarily amongst younger people, I guess, where the virus has been circulating the most. And in Scotland, there was the even more extreme, in some ways, measure of banning household visits completely, which Boris Johnson and the UK government have not quite gone that far. Derek, what was your take on the new measures, how they were brought in, the way they responded to that? From what Leslie Ann's saying there, it's pretty clear that something had to be done to try and stop or at least suppress this second wave, as we're now able to call it. What did you feel about how the government's handled it?
Yes, as you say, the new restrictions kind of focus on household visits, which was seen as one of the main areas of concern related to an upsurge in cases over the kind of recent weeks, and that 10 p.m. curfew for kind of all hospitality settings. I was actually speaking earlier this morning to Tony Cochrane, who is he owns a number of kind of pubs and clubs throughout Dundee, Aberdeen, right across Scotland, really. And he was talking about some of the pressures this is really putting on his business and businesses right across the country. That really, you already had a situation where people were limited in terms of how many people could go, having background music, all sorts of restrictions put in place for people who are coming in. But now you have this additional curfew of 10 p.m. And we've seen kind of concerns illustrated by the industry about whether actually bringing in this curfew means that, you know, if you're 18, 19 years old and you're going out for a night out on a Saturday, are you really going to go home at 10 o'clock and that's going to be the end of your night? Or are you going to leave the pub and go to a house party? And is that just going to kind of exacerbate things? But the First Minister has said that the action was kind of necessary to prevent a resurgence in community transmission and the potential for kind of rapid return to the pressure that we saw on the NHS earlier in the year. As Leslie Ann's kind of touched upon, one of the concerns here is that the virus starts with younger people and then moves on. And you see a situation like you've seen in maybe kind of France and Spain, where several weeks later, it moves on from being younger people who are getting this virus. And hopefully, you know, most of them are recovering, and the majority of them won't have, hopefully, long-term conditions going on from it. But it moves into that older generation, and then you start to see deaths rising again. And we've seen that even just over the last few days, where those deaths have been rising again. And of course, we focused on Callum O'Dwyer, a man from Aberdeen. I know his case has been referenced by the First Minister quite a few times, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
Over recent kind of daily briefings. He has what's been termed as kind of long COVID, which is people who get sick and then sort of get a little bit better and then start to feel worse again, and they have long-term fatigue and other kind of health complaints. So I think the action that's been taken here is really because they feel that we're getting to the stage where it is getting worse. So whilst a lot of the things that have been mentioned seem pretty tough and they haven't been welcomed, you've got to kind of wonder what else could they do. And I think there's also, Nicola Sturgeon's touched upon if there was greater financial power, she would have went even further.
Yeah, that's right.
In terms of hospitality. So
we'll come on to that in a minute, actually. But I was just thinking, Adele, I'll maybe bring you in at this point. What would you say the reaction has been to it in Aberdeen? I'm particularly thinking about the fact that there's the curfew on the pubs, which is having obviously going to have an effect on their business. And there's the household ban, which is obviously an issue for people who are maybe experiencing loneliness or mental health issues. And I suppose that's particularly acute in Aberdeen, which has just recently came out of a period of localized lockdown, which would have caused issues on all of those factors. What would you say has been the response to the developments this week where you are?
I've certainly noticed a sort of change in tone amongst people. There seems to be a kind of growing anger, I'd probably describe it as, in that, as you say, Aberdeen went under its local lockdown because we had a specific outbreak related to licensed premises. And I think people at the time understood that to a degree because it was very specific to businesses. It made sense that they would close. But you know, looking back, we had actually an extremely strict lockdown. We weren't able to go further than 5 miles. We weren't allowed to go into each other's houses and all our pubs and cafes shut. So I think there's been a sense of, you know, we look on at the central belt and see that the cases have increased. They brought in some measures for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. They appear to have done nothing to curb the rise in cases. And yet, if you live in Glasgow, you know, you can actually travel anywhere you like. And so there is a sense, I'd say a growing sense in Aberdeen of unfairness. And certainly from a business perspective, businesses up here have, many businesses have said, you know, if we have another lockdown or more restrictions, we don't think we're not going to survive. We've already seen my favorite pub actually has shut now for good.
Right, that is it. This COVID has done many things to many people, and it's shut your favorite pub as well.
Yeah, Under the Hammer, that's gone for good. So very, I was genuinely very upset by that. Uh-huh. But yeah, it is scary that there's a lot of businesses up here that just, you know, personally speaking, I live up here and I don't really ever feel like I got a relaxed period. It's just felt like, you know, lockdown measures after lockdown measures after lockdown measures without any chance to sort of relax a little bit. So,
and who's getting the blame? Is it Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish government's getting the blame? Are people just frustrated with the general circumstances, or is that disappointment and anger being vented on a particular figure?
It depends who you speak to, but I would say that the First Minister is coming under some criticism locally, just I think because people don't quite understand. They feel they maybe want to see more data, more scientific reasons why Glasgow didn't have a similar, you know, travel restriction, but yeah, Aberdeen did. And while they understand potentially now it's growing everywhere to a degree, they don't understand why the initial stricter decision wasn't taken in the central belt.
Okay, we'll come on to Nicola Sturgeon a bit more later on. Dan, I'll bring you in at this stage. I want to talk to you about the support package that the Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced yesterday, in which you were covering for us. But you live in London, obviously. What's the mood there? What's been the response to the lockdown? Obviously, London was at the epicenter of the COVID outbreak in the very early days in the beginning, but I guess things have felt a bit back to normal for a while in London, and now there's been changes. What's the mood there?
I'll be honest with you, a lot of people I speak to kind of have not foolishly really not been really paying attention to things. I mean, I think across England there's kind of a patchwork of restrictions. I mean, you know, I'm from the northwest of England, and you know, my family and you know, my partner's family are under various kind of different rules of, you know, not being able to kind of go out and mingle with more than a couple of people, or kind of stay over at other people's houses. But in London, it's not really, you know, the restrictions have kind of remained pretty similar since they were lifted or relaxed earlier this year. So it's kind of yet to really set in that we're kind of going back for a bit of a change. I mean, I think, you know, certainly with Boris Johnson's statement the other day, you know, we went from that pronouncement over the summer where he said, you know, life will be back to normal by Christmas, to now he's saying, you know, we'll survive the winter. You know, it's kind of it's changed somewhat this week. So I think there's maybe a bit of a lag about people kind of realizing that we're kind of heading back towards maybe a stricter form of living.
There's a fascinating topic there, actually, I think, because it feels to me that one of the issues from a political or even from a communications standpoint here, the impact of the messaging from the leader on on the community involved has been something that's been very prominent. So what you're describing there in England, I think that I've heard that described elsewhere from people in London and in other parts of England, that basically the Boris Johnson, due to his kind of, well, how could I put it charitably, is fairly untraditional communication style during this period, has meant that there's been a lack of consistency in message, and that's maybe led to people ignoring the measures more. Whereas Nicola Sturgeon's obviously been on TV here every day doing the daily briefing, has won plaudits, I think, from almost everyone other than her fiercest critics about her communication skills, if not necessarily the message. And I think that has led to possibly greater adherence to the rules and a greater understanding of what they are, which, you know, if you think about the fact that Scotland's under more draconian measures than certainly London and most of England, that's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, that the messaging is key, really. And I mean, I think people have become a little bit frustrated. I mean, it wasn't so long ago we were seeing kind of, you know, front pages that have been briefed out from Number 10 saying, you know, you need to start getting back to work or you'll lose your job, basically. And now, you know, we're being told, oh, work from home again if you can. You know, it's just, and, you know, there's the whole summer of the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, you know, but now the briefings have changed in tone, saying, you know, people have been irresponsible, they've not been paying attention. And I think they've expended a lot of goodwill with people in terms of just constantly changing messaging. And a lot of it is last minute, you know. So, again, there was this quite a lot of anger just before the weekend. They kind of said, oh, you know, the maximum number of people you can have at a wedding is going to drop by 15. You know, right before a weekend where people maybe were going to have a wedding celebration. I mean, they eventually kind of pushed it back to the Monday.
Yeah.
But it just kind of, it shows really like a lack of consideration, I think, for a population who have been on the, you know, it's a very difficult year for many people, and they may have already rearranged the wedding.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very difficult for a lot of people to kind of, you know, keep up to date with a lot of these guidelines.
And there'll be so many stories like that up and down the country. We'll move on to the political detail, Dan, and I'll stay with you, because you were running point on the Chancellor's announcement yesterday. Rishi Sunak, the master, the genius behind the furlough scheme, he's been thought to, you know, he's been getting a good write-up pretty much throughout the coronavirus pandemic. In your analysis for the Courier and Present Journal this morning, you've said that you think he may be losing his touch, that the magic may be gone. How do you think it went yesterday?
Well, I suppose we've become used to these set pieces now where, you know, over the last couple of months, you know, there's been, you know, announcements of restrictions or whatever, and then we see kind of Rishi kind of getting ready to make an announcement. You know, and there's been, you know, numerous policies, whether it's the bounce back loans, furlough scheme, Eat Out to Help Out, you know, all these kind of new and sparkly policies designed to kind of help, you know, keep people in work or help the economy. So, you know, when we were told earlier this week that, you know, restrictions are probably coming back, we were expecting this announcement. And yeah, I just felt, you know, he was there on hand with some, you know, some creative policy names, you know, this pay as you grow scheme, but, you know, a bit of a pun, and, you know, this job support scheme, which was similar in name to the job retention or, you know, furlough scheme. But then when you kind of actually inspect them a bit more, nowhere near on the same level as the support that was given. And I mean, this is from a man who said, you know, he would do whatever it takes to help.
Yeah.
I mean, you now get dig down into the details. So the furlough scheme, for example, you know, that was costing the Treasury around kind of, you know, £14 billion a month, and it was supporting millions of people across the country. You know, this is a scheme, of course, that pays 80% of workers' wages, the government do. This is now being phased out and replaced with this job support scheme. And if you look at how much money that's going to cost, I mean, it's going to be around £300 million a month. So much, yeah, much less cash from the Treasury. And essentially, it's going to ask employers to pay 55% of workers' wages, and the Treasury will give you an extra 22%. So, you know, workers will have a pay cut, and the employers will be asked to dig deep and pay a bit more as well. So, you know, on the face of it, compared to some of his previous ideas, that wasn't really, you know, as magic as some of his past policies have been.
Adele, you were drilling into the detail of this business support scheme for us and what some of the reaction has been from the business community and elsewhere. What are your general impressions and observations?
Yeah, so like Dan said there, the you will have to work at least a third of your normal hours under the scheme, and the employer will actually cover the wages for those hours worked and then a third of hours not worked. So I thought this was a really crucial point. That's equivalent to 55% of pay.
Yeah.
So you're asking businesses there to pay 55% of their employee's salary for only working 33% of hours worked, roughly a third. So I saw somebody saying yesterday, which I thought was quite interesting, that businesses therefore have to pay 100% of staff salaries for the hours they do work, but also top up the salaries for the hours not worked. So there's an argument there. Could some businesses, you know, seek to make staff redundant and then potentially hire in part-time people or freelancers and, you know, get around it that way? So I think
and that would be cheaper.
Yeah, that's because they wouldn't have to do that topping up. You would just be hiring people for the part-time hours. So I think that'd be interesting to see if that becomes a particular concern. I mean, in terms of the sort of general reaction, I spoke to some of the you know, the chambers of commerce, and they felt that it was still, you know, not tenable for governments to instruct businesses in key industries like the aviation industry, hospitality, and live events, who effectively either have huge limitations on their operations, or they've had to actually close. You know, the likes of theatres haven't been able to open at all, and yet they still have to find a way to survive with a scheme that really offers such a limited contribution. Because, you know, for some businesses, they won't even have enough work to go around to get people to work a third of their hours. So I think there's real limitations to, and as Dan says, it's a lot less than the furlough scheme in terms of support, but I guess on the flip side, the furlough scheme can't go on forever, so it's definitely, you know, it's a difficult balance there.
Dan, what did you make of the language that this was couched in yesterday? One of the things that struck me was he described them as, you know, supporting viable jobs, which has the inevitable implication that there are now jobs that are unviable. And the difference from the furlough scheme, I guess, was it was kind of seen as a bridge to support jobs through this process, and it feels like that some people are being pushed off the bridge now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I mean, it was quite noticeable yesterday, you know, that the way that the shift in tone from kind of some of his earlier statements where, you know, he was very keen to say, you know, look, you know, we've got your back, we're here for you, no, you know, no matter what, you know, we're here to support you. A lot of the phrases that, you know, he was using were kind of trying to convey almost in a coded way, you know, you're saying he cannot save every job. He said, you know, the economy is likely to undergo more permanent adjustments. We need to adapt to the new normal. It's all a way of him trying to say, like, look, you know, this is going to be here for a long time, and it's going to, you know, scar our economy in a massive way. I mean, as we've reported on, you know, in the past, the long-term damage it's going to do. And this is him saying, you know, we can't actually support you forever. And, you know, if you are in a job, you know, where perhaps you will not be going back anytime soon, it's time to maybe, you know, look for a new form of employment. I mean, good luck with that at the moment, because, you know, there's it's far outstripping, you know, the vacancies and all the rest of it. There's not a lot of jobs out there.
No.
You know, so this caused a lot of anger. You know, certainly, I mean, I've kind of listened to a couple of radio phone-ins, and I've heard a lot of kind of, you know, angry people who maybe work in the arts or other sectors, and they're saying, you know, I've made a career in this industry, and I've just basically been told I'm not viable anymore. So some of the magic's coming off Rishi Sunak, I think, by saying things like that. Definitely,
he's undoubtedly in a difficult position, though, I guess. What were the opposition parties saying? What did Labour and the SNP make of it all?
So Labour and the SNP, that they were kind of keen to welcome extra help, but they were also, you know, very much wanting to say, you know, this is a bit late, you know, considering how, you know, the furlough scheme's due to end very, very soon. You know, and they've been calling for some sort of either a replacement or an extension of furlough for months now. You know, Kate Forbes, the Scottish Finance Secretary, said yesterday, you know, that this just didn't go far enough at all, and said, you know, tens of thousands of jobs will be lost as a result. So it's kind of a little bit too late, and maybe not far enough. Certainly that's their view on it.
We'll move on to another issue, which I think has been one of the most affecting news stories we've had this week. You will never believe that this is possible, but it is, despite my youthful appearance. It is 20 years this week since I moved to Scotland to be a fresher at Glasgow University. And obviously the freshers at Glasgow University this year and in lots of other universities up and down the country are not having that normal fresher experience because they've been banned from the pubs and told to self-isolate after coronavirus spread through the halls of residence pretty quickly. Who could have seen that coming? Leslie Ann, you've got some stats on this before we get on to the details of the politics, I think.
Yeah, I just have some rough figures because there's no official data on where cases are at this kind of level, like schools, universities, etc. But just from us tracking the situation at Scottish universities, obviously Glasgow University have the most significant outbreak with 124 confirmed cases, which is sounds pretty serious.
It sure does.
Overall, at Scottish universities, I have counted 147 cases. However, the more staggering thing to me is the number of people that are locked down and are being told to self-isolate, which is over 1,100 students in Scotland right now are currently self-isolating.
That's just incredible.
Puts a big cramp on Freshers Week.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the thing that struck me about that this morning is that they really have had a difficult time because a lot of these people will be the same cohort that had the school exam chaos earlier in the summer. People who have maybe went through all that problems with the algorithm and whether they were getting marked down because, you know, some computer didn't like their school, whether they're going to get into university, they campaign and get the government to change that. So they get their place at university, they arrive excited and ready to go. And then they're hit with this as well. It really has been a difficult time for that group. Derek, can you, I was working a little bit last night on the paper whenever some of this university stuff was breaking and it seemed to be changing all the time and exactly what the situation wasn't particularly clear, and it looks to me like the communications wasn't great. Can you just give us a little reprise of what happened yesterday, what the measures have been implemented are, and exactly what went on?
Sure, absolutely. So you're right, there's been a lot of talk about sort of the wider effect of all the changes on this cohort of people coming in, but there's also criticism about the way some of the messaging has worked here. So we found out yesterday that students living in halls or flats now can't go back to their parents' homes. And that message was shared on Twitter by National Clinical Director Jason Leach, as opposed to any sort of official Scottish Government release or announcement. Professor Leach said the law was clear, so students in that position are, in fact, in separate households and now can't meet with another household, even if that's to go back and visit their mum and dad. The problem with that is that
I'll just stop you there a second before we go on to that. Because, yeah. I mean, the thing that strikes me about this is, let's be perfectly honest about this. If you're a 17-year-old, and you've just gone to university and you've been in halls a day and you don't know anybody and your mum and dad are worried about you and they're 60 miles up the road and Jason Leach is telling you on Twitter that you're not allowed to go home to your parents, do they honestly think that anyone is going to listen to that? Because clearly they're not. Is that not just the brass tacks of it?
I think that's fair. I mean, the universities have come out with statements of their own trying to back up some of the stuff that's been put out yesterday. But I think there will be a real concern. I mean, a lot of these people will be maybe away from home for the first time and, you know, living with people they don't know and dealing with all the stress and anxiety that we're all dealing with of this and having to deal with it effectively now on their own. I saw some people suggesting that if this is the way things are going to go, then should some students be offered a kind of refund and the opportunity to defer and come back again. I was going to mention that the problem with Professor Leach saying that the law was clear on this is that actually it wasn't very clear at all, because not only did the law which underpins it only come into force today and wasn't actually published at the stage he was saying all this, it's also a significant rollback on what he was saying even the night before. So the night before he was suggesting students should think hard about whether to go home, but, and I'm quoting him here, it's not going to be illegal. Nobody is going to put barriers up. And when journalists contacted the Scottish Government Press Office last night for some kind of official statement or some kind of clarification on this, they were told they should refer back to Jason Leach's tweet. So that's where the information is coming from on this. We also had
Jason Leach's tweet.
Yeah, that seems to be where policy is getting announced now. I mean, it's there in the kind of legislation, but I mean, I don't think that's what anyone was reading into it. Certainly not Jason Leach, from the sounds of it. We also had, as you touched upon late last night, a statement from University of Scotland and the Scottish Government saying students will be required not to go to pubs or restaurants this weekend. That was the word in the news, required. There was a bit of a mix-up initially with people thinking that would be a sort of permanent situation and that would be every weekend until things are lifted. But again, we got clarification on Twitter, this time from the First Minister, that in fact that was not the case. And University of Scotland has also acknowledged that, in fact, it's not actually enforceable to do that. So obviously some universities might take a dim view if students are going out and ignoring that request. But from their point of view, there's not actually any kind of legislation to stop them from doing that. Now, apparently, a lot of the problem here in terms of the language and in terms of everything around this is that the Scottish Government were putting a lot of pressure on University of Scotland to get this release out as quickly as possible. And the result of that has been an absolute muddle of communications. And you know, the Scottish Government's been probably quite rightly congratulated for the clarity of their messaging in the past during this pandemic. But this has been a bit of a mess, really, even in the suggestion of whether or not students can go home this Christmas, which has been something that's been talked about south of the border. I think Matt Hancock said it was something they couldn't rule out, a kind of ban on students being allowed to go home. The First Minister's official spokesman yesterday said it was too early to say. So, I mean, it's this huge onslaught of potential restrictions and things being kind of imposed on students. So underpinning all of this, and I think it, just bubbling beneath the surface, there is kind of really serious discussions about the mental health aspect for them as well, of being kind of cooped up and having to deal with all this kind of breaking on Twitter.
What have you made of it all, Adele?
Yeah, it's become something of a, you know, it's become from an incident, it's now a kind of full-blown crisis by the looks of it. You know, I can't help but think of my own experience.
Which was probably slightly more recent than mine.
I think it was about 12 years ago, so a little bit more recent. At Edinburgh University, and I know I think of that tiny little bedroom that I had, and yeah, I just can't, you know, you're in some cases, you know, people in Scotland are 17 years old. They're certainly not, probably don't feel like full adults yet. And as you say, as Derek says, you know, your mental health and just trying to cope with being away from mum and dad and meeting loads of new people, and you're not able to make those, form those new connections. And I think it's going to be really, really difficult for them. And I think that, yeah, it all kind of playing out on Twitter is just not good enough either. I think you're going to have anxious parents, anxious students, and it just begs the question, should they even have gone at all, given most of the lectures are being performed online anyway?
Well, the good news for the hundreds of students self-isolating at Parker House Halls of Residence in Dundee is I've just sent them a couple of hundred copies of The Courier, so they will have something to do this morning. This is clearly been a terrible cock-up, and I don't disagree that it's a very difficult situation for the government and the authorities, because they've taken the decision that the universities had to go back, the students had to go, and there's been this big outbreak, and how to deal with that is clearly very difficult, and it was all happening very quickly, and that makes communication difficult as well. But, you know, when you're banning people from pubs, telling 17-year-olds they can't go home and see their parents, you would expect that to have some impact on the politicians that are making those decisions, and especially if they're doing it in a slightly shambolic way. Yet we said the same about the school exams crisis early in the summer whenever all that issue happened, and it certainly didn't dent the popularity of Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish Government. So I thought, just before, we haven't got much time left, but just before we finish, I thought it might be worth having a bit of a reflection on, you know, Derek, I'll start with you. Do you think that this university crisis will have any impact on Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish Government's popularity?
In short, probably not. I mean, I think Nicola Sturgeon was accused of failing to plan for the outbreak, and there's been talk of there's some walk-in testing centres which are supposed to be opening near universities. I think by the end of October, only about half of them are, of the 22 of them are actually going to be open. You've also got, I mean, our own advisors have kind of highlighted how important the kind of testing is, and potentially mass testing. Right across the board, there does seem to be problems here. But I mean, we saw with schools and with other, you know, with care homes, none of that seems to have dented Nicola Sturgeon's approval ratings or poll ratings for the SNP. So, in short, no, I don't think it will, probably.
Adele?
No, I'd have to agree with that. I think she'll probably come under fire during today's briefing, probably more than she has in any other occasion. But I don't think it's going to, you know, long term affect. And I think that's down to the fact, I think as we've discussed, you know, there's not that credible alternative. And so people both compare her to the Prime Minister and because her communication style is seen as being so much clearer, and because there's not potentially trying to be careful here a strong enough there's not enough popularity for the opposition.
The opposition's rubbish. That's what you meant.
Yeah, so I don't think it's going to have any serious implications for the First Minister or the SNP.
Dan, the Guardian asked me to write something this week about the Scottish independence issue and how COVID's impacted it. And the thing that I kind of focused on was, you know, Nicola Sturgeon's presence on television here, which has been so ubiquitous, and how that has compared with Boris Johnson, and also just Nicola Sturgeon's kind of prominence in Scottish public life over the last 6 months. What's the view on London from that? Because you do tend to find that Nicola Sturgeon's quite admired by certainly progressives in London, and the comparison with Boris Johnson is quite stark there, and clearly that would be the same case in Scotland when you're seeing Boris Johnson and Nicola Sturgeon side by side, that Nicola Sturgeon's communicative talents perhaps outstrip his. Is that the view in London, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people down here are kind of exasperated that, you know, the UK government, well, they try and sell it that the UK government have kind of, you know, put their arms around all four nations of the UK, and you know, they can't understand why they're not getting a better press in Scotland. But I think, you know, Boris Johnson's style is very unique, and I think, you know, it appeals to a certain section of, I would say, English nationalism that doesn't really convey well in Scotland. And, you know, I think this was always the problem. I mean, you know, when he kind of got elected, this was always spoken about, that he would have a Scotland problem. And I think, you know, it's kind of played out throughout this pandemic, really. And I think, you know, having those daily, well, I mean, when Boris did them, I mean, those daily conferences side by side, I mean, the contrast between the two was unbelievable, really.
Well, I mean, the thing that I think has been very amusing about that is that, and we are really running out of time, so I'm going to bring it to a close now. But in Scotland, there's been a lot of argument and pressure for the First Minister not to do daily press conferences, whereas in London, they're being Boris Johnson is understandably being criticised for not doing any press conferences. So I mean, it's quite stark when the opposition are calling for the First Minister to not be scrutinised on television on a daily basis. We're really getting to something, and that is the reason why I'm going, because Derek Healy has to dash off to take part in today's daily briefing. So we'll bring things to a close here. I'll thank Derek, Adele, Leslie Ann and Dan for joining me. I'll thank Chris for producing. I'll thank you for joining us, and I've been David Clegg. Cheers.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshy from DC Thompson Media.